This is Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Cameron Costa. Today on our podcast, TikTok, the app of Microsoft's eye. A roller coaster weekend for the social media platform, from a presidential threat to a big tech bid. Former CEO of Microsoft, Steve Ballmer, on TikTok's potential deal.
It's an exciting avenue for Microsoft to really increase its consumer base.
Plus, Ballmer, the chairman of the LA Clippers, says it's finally time for sports.
Society wants some sense of normalcy. Society wants sports. Sports rallies people. It brings people together.
And a stimulus stalemate. How one restaurateur is troubleshooting his own business while he awaits a new round of government relief.
Here we are today, and I feel just as nervous about the future as I did back in the beginning of March when coronavirus was coming over the horizon.
It's Monday, August 3rd, 2020. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. I'm Becky Quick, along with Andrew Ross Sorkin and Scott Wapner. Joe is out today, but Scott, we're thrilled to have you with us. How you doing?
I'm doing well, guys. It's good to be with you this morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good to see you.
First up on today's podcast, TikTok's wild weekend. TikTok is a short-form video social media platform extremely popular with Gen Z and millennials. During the global pandemic, the app outpaced Instagram in terms of downloads, hitting the 2 billion mark back in April. If you know any teens or adults locked down and bored, you're probably familiar with the platform. TikTok has over 200 million users in the US, but it's owned by Chinese company ByteDance, which is where most of the political drama begins. United States Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has consistently voiced concerns about the app's ties to the Chinese government. Back in July, he lumped TikTok in with Huawei in terms of national security.
We are now evaluating each instance where we believe that U.S. citizens' data that they have on their phones or in their system or in their healthcare records, we want to make sure that the Chinese Communist Party doesn't have a way to easily access that.
President Trump this weekend suggested banning the app in the U.S.
We're looking at TikTok. We may be banning TikTok. We may be doing some other things. There are a couple of options.
And Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin has confirmed that the department's Committee on Foreign Investments in the U.S. is reviewing TikTok, citing those same national security concerns. He spoke to ABC over the weekend.
I do chair CFIUS, which is the Committee on Foreign Investment on the United States. I've said publicly that it's under review. I will say publicly that the entire committee agrees that TikTok cannot stay in the current format because it risks sending back information on 100 million Americans.
Amid Washington's focus on national security, Microsoft announced that it may buy TikTok, or at least part of it. Over the weekend, the tech giant confirmed that it's in talks to acquire the TikTok business in the US, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, and that it's working with the government on the deal. Here's Becky Quick.
Andrew, what do you think about this story? I mean, I've been going back and forth, and it's an impressive maneuver that Satya Nadella was able to kind of talk to President Trump and kind of figure through what might be a window for this. But it still seems to me like there are a lot of potential risks. It seems like it would be great for Microsoft if they can do this, if they can pull this off. But I do think about a Chinese administration feeling like they are getting kind of shown up and looking for some way to go around that and maybe even say, no, you can't sell and you can't move the servers to the United States.
My take is mixed. I think it could work for Microsoft. I think it could be a great thing for Microsoft if they could turn themselves into a consumer juggernaut and if they could somehow leverage the Xbox brands and Minecraft and other things and make it work. It's not clear that they will be able to make it work. They've also had, as you know, some failure in the consumer space, Bing being an example, the acquisition of Nokia. They've done a remarkable job working and having a core and a focus on the business enterprise customer. And one of my worries is that owning a social media platform in this day and age requires a lot of attention in Washington and all sorts of things. So what type of attention is that going to take in terms of management focusing on that relative to what is clearly a profitable enterprise and business right now? On the flip side, if they're able to succeed, it creates competition to Facebook. It creates competition potentially to Google and others. So there's so many different directions that I could see this go, both in very positive directions, but also I could see the challenges ahead as well.
Next on Squawk Pod, more on the TikTok story with Steve Ballmer, former CEO of Microsoft.
I think our whole situation as a country with China is incredibly complex. Incredibly complex.
Plus, Ballmer's take on sports in the pandemic, rising and falling COVID-19 cases, and the possibility of breaking up big tech.
You can't be in any business of size and not have to think about regulatory issues and political issues.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Squawk Pod with Becky Quick, Andrew Ross Sorkin, and Scott Wapner.
The tech news of the morning, Microsoft moving ahead with plans to buy TikTok in the United States. The China-owned short video app is a smash hit among younger social media users, but there's a lot of concern over the security of Americans' user data. After speaking with Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella, President Trump now giving that company 45 days to get a deal done. Joining us to discuss this is, well, so much more, key data points in the coronavirus pandemic, and of course, basketball, is Steve Ballmer, former Microsoft CEO, founder of USA Facts, chairman of the Los Angeles Clippers. There is so much to get to you with Steve, and I want to talk about USA Facts because you're doing a real public service on some important COVID numbers and a new project, which I do want to talk about. But I got to get your thoughts, if we could, on this potential transaction between Microsoft and TikTok. If you were running Microsoft today, would you want to buy this company?
I think it's an exciting I say this as the shareholder at this stage. I think it's an exciting proposition for Microsoft. Obviously, it depends on the price. Price is important, and as well as whatever restrictions come with it from a government perspective. But I think it's an exciting avenue for Microsoft to really increase its consumer base.
Let me ask you, as somebody who has bought consumer businesses before, and Microsoft has, I think it's fair to say, a mixed record on some of the consumer businesses. It's been, I'm thinking of Bing, obviously, the Nokia transaction. On the other end, Xbox has been a wild success. Minecraft has been a wild success. How do you see this playing out for Microsoft, which has done so well recently by focusing, frankly, on the business enterprise consumer?
Well, I think, as you point out, there's successes and failures in the consumer business. And I think it's important to remember, you've got to keep trying new things in order to build new businesses. Microsoft's legacy actually is in the consumer business and built an enterprise business. Skype acquisition went really well, little bit there that missed the Zoom wave and the work from home wave. But here we are, we're doing Skype today. So I think there's nothing systemic in Microsoft, and I think it's an important addition to Microsoft's business model from a revenue perspective.
And then finally, how do you think, though, as a manager about running a business like this? You know, if you're running a social media company today, you are in the crosshairs of Washington in an entirely different way. Microsoft was not at that meeting, or virtual meeting, I should say, last week. Mark Zuckerberg spends an enormous amount of his time and attention dealing with various political issues which come up on the platform, and the same types of issues, frankly, that Washington is worried when it comes to TikTok and the presence of China involved in it.
Well, you can't be in any business. I know this from personal experience on our antitrust matters. You can't be in any business of size and not have to think about regulatory issues and political issues. Even on the enterprise business, there's always issues of national sovereignty. Where do you store data and the like? This would be a continuation of the theme, and I think Microsoft's got a real sophistication about that, born of history and a track record of having to work with governments and understanding that government is part of the fabric of everything.
Hey, Steve, I just want to say, man, you are the largest shareholder in Microsoft, and boy, do you look smart at this point, holding on to all these shares and watching that stock rise. I just wonder, as you've seen the stock climb, we were just looking at the last 10 years of the stock taking off, have you thought about selling any more shares, or do you like being the biggest shareholder in Microsoft?
I think it's been a pretty good investment, as you highlight, and I've got all I'll ever need to live on, and so mostly what you could say is we're managing money for our our philanthropic giving for foundation. And so in a sense, why sell? Why, you know, absorb capital gains taxes? I love Microsoft. I love it as an entity. I love what it stands for. And I have a certain loyalty. So no, I don't expect to sell any more shares. Now, if our philanthropic needs get big enough, I guess I'll have to take a look at it. But I feel pretty good right now.
As you should. Steve, it's Scott. It's nice to see you. I wanted to go back to the TikTok conversation, if I may, and ask you for your reaction to what Peter Navarro suggested on TV this weekend, that Microsoft essentially was too close to the Chinese Communist Party, referring, I think presumably he's referring back to even including your tenure as CEO. Is there something to be worried about here, about Microsoft's relationship with China? Is it too close and cozy?
Well, I think it's really hard to say that. If Microsoft was tight and cozy with the Chinese government, Microsoft's business would be bigger in China. Certainly it wasn't when I left. And as good as earnings growth has been over the last several years, if the Chinese market was as piracy-free as the rest of the world, if the Chinese market was as accepting of Microsoft's enterprise services as the rest of the world, Microsoft would be really, I think, quite a bit bigger. I can't peer inside the numbers, but I feel pretty confident in what I'm saying.
I want to talk about what you're doing with USA Facts and the NBA, but just one final question on this. If you were a company like Apple today, or another American company that does a lot of business in China, and by the way, Microsoft is one of them as well to some degree, would you be worried about a backlash?
Hard to predict. Really hard to predict. I think in general, the way things are going between the U.S. and China, you can predict some level of friction, whether this happens or doesn't happen. We've seen what happened with Huawei. And this has some elements of that, but I think at the end of the day, you're going to have a big Chinese company that wants to take good care of this asset, and whether that is selling to Microsoft or one of the other options they have, I think the acquisition can be a good one at the right price, but I don't really know what's going on. I can't say that I've got any real information, but as a shareholder, as I said, I'd be excited.
Okay, Steve. I want to talk about USA Facts because, as I said, you've been doing a public service with this with this website, really putting a lot of numbers together. You've now created a new recovery hub that's really looking at the COVID-19 pandemic that we're living through, but also trying to take that and really add the numbers and crunch them together. What's the biggest surprise that you've noticed in terms of the data thus far?
Well, I'm going to list a couple things. Everybody knows the stimulus is large. Most people don't recognize we have already spent one quarter as much just on the stimulus as we spent in our entire government spending last year. We spent about $4.4 trillion this year so far as a country. We've already, by August 1, spent over $5 trillion. It's really remarkable. Now, maybe not surprising, but if you put it in context, you can go, whoa, that really blows my head back. And yet there's still things we don't know. We don't get, this is a lament for mine about government data. We don't get real-time government data from our state and local governments. One of the debates in the next stimulus package is how much support, if any, do those entities need? Sorry, I wouldn't know how to form an opinion. And as a citizen, I'd like to form an opinion based on the data. You know, if you take a look at what's going on in people's lifestyle, the truth of the matter is that spending is up. Income is up by about 5%. Spending's down about 8%. Now, that's remarkable because what it says is the savings rate of our country's gone from 8% and to 19% over this period of time. Wow. Quite remarkable. And yet, we still don't know for whom life has changed.
I was just going to ask, the takeaway on the distinction between those two numbers, almost a contrarian in terms of what I think we would have thought initially, what does that say about, for example, this $600 stimulus plan or $600 a week unemployment insurance plan that is now back on the table. Do you think that we need it? Do you think we don't need it? What is the lesson, the takeaway of these numbers, you think?
Well, of course, we, as I said, want to be able to dive deeper. My intuition looking at the numbers is we really should be well targeted at who gets 600 and who does not. If we had the IT systems in place, what we'd really want to do, I think, we don't have all the data, is target people at the lower end of the income spectrum. You could say it might get them above their earnings, but we're talking about people for whom this might represent just above subsistence level if they were provided the money.
Right. Steve, as somebody who's now spent a lot of time looking at data and actually working the data behind the scenes, because you're crunching it and taking it from different various sources, how much would it cost us to get good data? Part of the problem we have, as you keep mentioning, is we have bad data in this country. We have this is also a testing issue, by the way, for COVID. We have bad testing, so we don't have good numbers. Therefore, we can't do good tracing. What do you think the cost, and I'm not talking about the cost necessarily of testing per se, but the cost of getting the right kind of data that you're looking for so that we can make educated decisions really is?
I think there's a whole lot of improvement that is just about free. I think if the purpose of our statistical agencies was actually to help decision makers make decisions as opposed to just provide economists a mass of data for analysis, I actually think we could make incredible progress for essentially nothing. Second step would be to make the IT work harder. I don't think this stuff is necessarily as well automated. And number three would be to publish it in a much more understandable form. Then on top of that, I'm sure there's money maybe that needs to be added in. But, you know, like any businessman, let's go get the low-hanging fruit. Might get us 80% of, you know, the way to where we need to be.
Steve, I wanted to get your opinion on what we saw last week on Capitol Hill with big tech, testifying. And ask you a question this way. If you were still running Microsoft, one of these gigantic technology companies that have done so well, which of the others would keep you up at night as a competitor? Would it be Apple? Would it be Google? Would it be Amazon? Would it be Facebook, and why?
Well, from where Microsoft is today, it would clearly, to me, be Amazon. Amazon's AWS product and Microsoft's Azure and Office 365 products, they actually compete. So that would be the one that kept me up at night. Now, in terms of the frontier of consumer competition, that's a whole different thing, if you will. And, the promise of what you don't have probably feels less competitive than the opportunity and the battle you're in right now. So I'd certainly pick Amazon and Azure.
Hey, Steve, you look at what's happening with Major League Baseball and just think, wow, what the heck happened? You guys clearly have a better plan with basketball.
So far, so good. I think our league has done a very good job. This whole notion of having a bubble. I was down in Orlando last week. I don't get to go in the bubble. There's a separate owner's bubble, if you will, and those are kept well apart. Let me say managing partners. The word owner is offensive, but, managing partners bubble, it is separate. We actually, behind glass, with no contact, we're allowed to many rows up, we're allowed to watch games. But I think it is incredibly well done. I mean, last week alone, I had 4 COVID tests. And our players, as you know, are having the opportunity to stay healthy to get tested more. People are being fined. Players are being fined for not wearing masks. Super thorough, super good job, super well, actually, from the use of IT. And so far, so good. Things have worked out tremendously well. The broadcasts have shown innovation. Virtual fans through Microsoft Teams, that kind of got me a little excited, I have to say. And I think, in general, the broadcast looks awfully good. So I just, a lot of praise to the NBA and a lot of praise to the teams. The teams came back ready to play. We'd had close games. We'd seen people play really well. So I think things have been pretty good.
What did you think of the 10-day quarantine for Lou Williams in terms of and the penalties that he's gotten? Fair? Unfair? What does it do for the team?
No, I mean, I think you have to look at it. This is not about penalties or anything else. It's about health. And I think the league said Lou had put himself in a position where potentially he had touched more people than the league would have wanted under the quarantine rules. Now, people can take a look and talk about the rest of it. But, you know, Lou's a great man in addition to being a great player. And, you know, he has to go through this quarantine process, and the rest is for, you know, society to have its own opinion. But, you know, I am glad we're going to get Lou back for our next game, let him have a chance to play, and know that he's taking care of his contact issue, potential contact issues with people who are sick.
You just mentioned something really interesting, that you yourself had 4 COVID tests last week. And what do you say, Steve, to those? And believe me, I'm the biggest sports fan in the world and happy as anybody that sports are back in the magnitude that they are and working out well for the most part. But what do you say to those who suggest that our priorities are messed up? Here is an NFL majority partner who's gotten 4 tests last week. I still can't get a test. And if I even do get a test, I have to wait 7 to 10 days, if not longer, to get the results. How do you answer that?
Well, what I would say is this. First of all, NBA, not NFL. We've got very different practices there, Scott, sorry to say. But, you know, the rules laid down by government allows this testing. And given that that's the case, the league has gone ahead. And I think that's sensible. And if, you know, we talked about government earlier. Talked about USA facts and government data. We talked about regulation. This is an area where if government wanted to do things differently, it certainly could. I do also think society wants some sense of normalcy. Society wants sports. Sports rallies people. It brings people together. Even now, particularly with the issues of Black Lives Matter and racial equity, I think it's important to actually get sport going and let our players speak out on these important issues.
Hey, Steve, on that point, you know, it was remarkable to see all of the players taking that knee. It's been something to see Black Lives Matter written across the court. As you know, when Colin Kaepernick first took the knee, and there were questions of NBA owners and even Adam Silver about whether players NBA players should take the knee. The answer was it was against the policy. We'll find other outlets for them to talk about these issues. Do you think that was appropriate in retrospect?
Well, I think at the time, it's important to have these things really discussed between the league and our partner, which is the Players Association. I mean, essentially, we split revenue 50-50. We're locked on the same issues. It was part of our collective bargaining agreement at the time. And the league and the Players Association worked out something in addition to allow our players to express themselves, which I think is fantastic. I think now is a time where things have to happen on the racial equality sense, whether it's police reform or improvements in education and others. And, you know, was that a mistake at the time? No, that was the rules that both the Players Association and the league had put in place. We changed them for good reasons.
And then finally, before you go, and this relates really to China, talking about going back in time, you know, Steve Kerr said that he thought he made a mistake in terms of his comments, if you remember, at the time around what was happening with China and what the league had done in reaction to China. What's your take now on all of that?
I think our whole situation as a country with China is incredibly complex, incredibly complex. We have an extensive and deep business relationship. So it's clear that the principle for our society isn't don't do any business in China. If you're going to do some business in China, then you're in the country. You have to operate by rules that are appropriate in China. But we have free speech in this country, but we see civil rights issues. So I think it's all nuanced. And I can't say there was anything else to expect. There'll be people in the United States who were upset with what the league did. There's people in the United States who will support. There's a need for good business collaboration. I think almost anything the league would have done would have brought with it a bit of controversy, as most things with China does.
Okay, fair enough. Steve Ballmer, it is always a privilege to spend time with you. We appreciate you joining us, especially on such a newsy morning like today. Want to encourage all the viewers to go out and check out USA Facts to get those facts, as you always say, to make your own decisions about what's happening in this country. We appreciate and hope to talk to you again very soon, Steve. Thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up on Squawk Pod, a nationwide restaurateur awaiting a second round of relief.
There are thousands and thousands of businesses like ours out there in the country that are hurting terribly. We cannot survive.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Squawk Pod.
Good morning. Welcome back to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. I'm Andrew Ross Sorkin, along with Becky Quick and Scott Wapner, who's hanging out with us today. Joe is off. Welcome to you, Scott.
All right, Andrew, thanks. An update now on stimulus talks in Congress. Trump administration officials and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi are set to resume negotiations today on their competing visions of a bill. A sticking point continues to be the federal boost to unemployment assistance, which was set at $600 per week in March, but lapsed on Friday. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said yesterday that he and Speaker Pelosi are on the same page about the need for direct cash payments of $1,200 to most Americans.
We have the perfect guest to talk about just that. Joining us right now on the topic of small business and what he's seeing is Cameron Mitchell. He's the founder and CEO of Cameron Mitchell Restaurants, which owns nearly 60 establishments across the United States. And Cameron, it's great to see you. It's been a while since we've spoken.
Good morning, Becky. It's a pleasure to be back with you today.
So the first time we talked to you was in the midst of the shutdown when all of your restaurants had been closed down. You laid out a plan for what you were hoping to see.
2 weeks ago on March 3rd, I was in Washington, D.C. to meet with my bankers, and I expressed to them what a great start to the year we had. We're up 7% same store sales, record profitability for the first 2 months of the year. This was March 3rd. Tomorrow, I believe March 19th, we will be completely shut down. I laid off 4,200 people on Monday.
The last time we talked to you, things were looking pretty good. Business was back and was booming.
I think we're going to survive, but it's going to be a while before we get out of the hospital. We expect to be open and hopefully back to full employment by the end of June or end of July, somewhere in that neighborhood.
So what's happening right now?
Becky, the best way I can equate it to is we're in a hurricane, and the first landfall of the hurricane was back in March 15th, and it was as detrimental as it was and terrible as it was. We ended up getting the PPP money, and we're able to get out and get open, and it was a lifeline. We would not be here today if it wasn't for the original PPP loan. And June came, and sales were doing pretty good. We were about 75% of last year's sales. We're feeling very optimistic, and what I came to realize is we were really just in the eye of the storm. And then July, the beginning of July hit, and the case counts rising across the country, metropolitan areas rolling back opening guidelines and further restrictions on our business, and sales fell down to now 50% of last year, and that is just not sustainable. So here we are today, you know, August 2nd, and I feel just as nervous about the future as I did back in the beginning of March when coronavirus was coming over the horizon. So we're looking for a second round of PPP to help us get through the other side and help us sustain for the future. So the thing we're hearing mostly in Congress is about the stimulus checks and the unemployment, but there are thousands and thousands of businesses like ours out there in the country. They're hurting terribly. At 50% decline, 40% decline in sales, we cannot survive. We're losing between $500,000 and $1 million a month, and we need the additional PPP dollars in a terrible way. And, you know, the current proposal is for a $2 million cap on that, which last time was $10 million. And so for a company like ours and many others, that reduction of $8 million is when we need it the most is very difficult for us.
Cameron, is the decline in your business coming mostly because states or local municipalities have forced you to not open as much and to close things down? Or how much of the decline is coming from people who are afraid to go out? How would you measure that, the difference?
Well, it's both. Clearly, when you have a reduction in capacity from municipality, example, Beverly Hills, we're closed. All restaurants in California closed for indoor dining. New York City, we were not allowed to open our restaurant. That was just for the patio. Philadelphia, we're not allowed to open. That got rolled back from August 1st now to September 1st. So some of our businesses are not even open yet. But the main driver of that reduction of sales is the increased case count with coronavirus around the country and people becoming more and more nervous about going to restaurants. Even though there's no science dates that says inherently restaurants, COVID case outbreaks have been driven by restaurant seating, indoor and outdoor seating.
Cameron, what are you doing in terms of your relationship with your landlords, particularly in some of those places where the restaurants haven't even reopened yet? Are you getting any forgiveness or any easing of things from them?
Well, that's the thing, Becky. You know, we had almost all of our landlords help out in some way or another. Not all, but some, or most, I should say. But that money is just a simple deferral. That's so we have an additional $3 million we got deferred in rent April, May, and June. But that money has to be paid back over various schedules over the next 2 years. So that's just additional debt on the balance sheet. And we come out of this without PPP. One of the things, Cameron Mitchell Restaurants, we build three or four restaurants a year, and if we're saddled with millions of dollars of debt, if and when we get out of this, I don't see us building and aiding the economic rebound in the country in 21 and 22 going further if we're saddled with all this debt.
What have you heard from the senators you've spoken with on this?
Well, I've spoken personally to both our senators in the state of Ohio, and they understand our plight, but I think all the negotiation right now is over the $600 a week stimulus for unemployment benefits. So I don't think it's getting much attention that it needs right now. And I hope by the time we get this bill and some sort of agreement between both parties on this bill that we can get this PPP round two stimulus, which has $190 billion earmarked for it, which should be more than enough for these companies that pass the stress test that show they actually need it. To keep at the original PPP levels as PPP1.
Cameron, I want to thank you for the update. We hope to check in with you again soon, but we appreciate your time and wish you good luck.
Thank you, Becky. Thank you very much.
That's the show for today. Thank you for listening. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin, weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 a.m. Eastern. To get the smartest takes and analysis from our TV show right into your ears, subscribe to Squawk Pod wherever you get your podcasts. And let us know what you think. Give us a rating and a review wherever you listen. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.